We would like to have your attention just really quickly. We wanted to present Yesenia with a great deal of appreciation for all of the work that she's done with organizing this semester. And I don't know if any of you have been at any of the other events that we've had, but it's just been really well organized, as we can see from the crowded room. So if we could all just give Yesenia a big round of applause.
She has really done pretty much everything that the workshop has done this semester, and you know, when we started it last year, she's just been such a powerful force and voice and everything, and we love and appreciate you so much. So, thank you.
Okay.
This workshop is a wonderful, like, this is not my congratulations speech, but like, seriously, it's been such an alienating experience being a student of color in this space, quite frankly, as we all know. Matthew's shaking his head. You guys are my family, so thank you.
All right, we'll get started. My name is Senya, as you all know, and I'm just going to talk about the workshop for a little bit, but before I do that, I want to welcome our spring coordinator, Yuane Watson.
Okay, so I'm a second year master's student in African American Studies here at Columbia, and got introduced to Senya, Matthew, JT, Romeo, bunch of other folks who put together the workshop, sort of like, you know, to have a space to work through issues and to present papers and whatnot, and introduce folks, brilliant folks, someone like who you're about to see. And in the spring, I'll be working to sort of bring more and similar events, just like that I experienced now, and really sort of following the footsteps of folks like Senia and other peers and colleagues who have been just doing a wonderful and great job. So I look forward to seeing you in the spring. Make the journey out, make some time, and come and support us with everything that we do. And thank you for being here today.
Yeah, so I attended a first meeting, and I was like, I want to be a part of it. So I offered to be Yuane's kickstand, like whatever he means, I can take on some of that role. So thank you for bringing me on.
And then just point out some of the organizers in case you do want to talk to someone about the workshop. Romeo. Raise your hand, Yuane, just raise your hand, and Matthew, Colvin, cool, Nick, yeah. So if you want to ask questions, just ask to these people too as well, and JT, and sorry. Okay, so we'll move on. For those of you who don't know, the workshop on critical approaches to race and ethnicity is an interdisciplinary space for people who are working on critical approaches to race and ethnicity. And so we host academic workshops. For example, last time we had a dissertation workshop with Matt Morrison. Next semester we're going to do a sort of reading group kind of thing with event with Walter Johnson's paper on agency. But it's not just an academic space, it's also a space of activism and culture. For example, this is Ashanti is an activist who's going to speak to us about his thoughts. And then last time, we had a Haitian American artist, Richard Omiarius, who brought his artwork here. So it's a dynamic space in that regard. And lastly, it's also a space for students of color to organize together. That's one of our other projects. We have many other projects in that vein. And if you want more information about that, you can speak to us individually. And then, I guess, just overall, we want to make the academy and education an exciting, dynamic, and provocative space, which is, I think, best. Reflected in our next speaker. So without further ado, I'll introduce Ashanti Alston. Ashanti is a former member of the Black Panther Party and ex-political prisoner. He publishes the zine Anarchist Panther and has been a guest lecturer at the Institute for Social Ecology in Vermont, speaking on the Panthers and the history of Black nationalist movements. He has spent time in Chiapas, Mexico, studying the autonomous structures of the Zapatistas communities and working on his memoirs. Ashanti resides in Rhode Island, where he is presently the national co-chair of the Jericho Amnesty Movement and an active member of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and the Jericho Movement. So thank you, Ashanti.
I would get that light if I step right in the middle. Oh, okay. Okay. How y'all doing?
Good.
All right. All right. First thing, y'all got to help me out because the butterflies is working. So usually start off with power to the people, and you know what I would like for you to give me back is all power to the people. All right. So if you give me that, you see what it does. It chemically releases the butterflies inside you and they fly out to you. So power to the people.
All power to the people.
Power to the people.
All power to the people.
Right on, because that's where it should go, right? All power to the people. We didn't say the politicians, we didn't say the preachers, we didn't say all the other con artists in that world of power over us. You know, we can determine our own destiny. You know, so that's what it's always been about. You know, from the days in the Black Panther Party, you know, I still carry that. You know, it still kind of defines me. I want to see that kind of world happen. All right. I want to thank the workshop on critical approaches to race and ethnicity for inviting me, and Sandra in particular for reaching out to me. I had something that I use sometimes. It's from Felipe Luciano. Does anyone know who that is? Young Lords, one of the New York leaders of the Young Lords Party. And so this was back in maybe like 1969. They had this experimental college. And they asked him to come and pose some questions to this student body. So I'm going to give you the questions, all right? And it's going to give you a sense of how... not just so much radical, but how we were willing to step out of the box. So the first question that he asked these students, have you had a good orgasm? Good question, right? And why? You know, because this is this time in the 60s where people are trying to be free. Not only the political and economic structures, but even the body structures, the body prisons that we had learned to take on. You know, to be able to experience ourselves and each other, you know. So that became, you know, like a really important question back then. So when you study that movement, you see people, you know, the free love and the love-ins and people streaking through, you know, different places is trying to get rid of certain other kinds of prisons. Now, the other one is, have you ever been really hurt physically or emotionally? Now, why that question, you know? Because he wants to know how in touch we are with our feelings and what we go through. You know, because being in this country, it can make us very insensitive. It can shut us down in many ways. And one of the good signs of a revolutionary was, can you feel? And it's not just the good feelings. You gotta feel, you know, there's pain too in this life. But everything has lessons and they can be good things. You know, they don't necessarily have to be bad things. And then the last one was, and sometimes I get into trouble for saying the last one, but I want to give you an understanding of it. Are you willing to carry a gun for what you believe? He asked these students that. Now, I'm not going to say carry a gun, but what does it mean when someone poses a question like that? It pretty much means, are you willing to go all the way with what you believe in? Are you willing to risk your life? Are you willing to risk your death? Are you willing to take those kind of steps that you know there's social structures out there, there's agents of repression out there who will come after you and will hurt you, kill you, disappear you, and all them other things? So he gave these students something to think about. But now this is the late 60s. There's still strong movements. We don't necessarily have them there, but the questions still are relevant. It's still relevant. So that's just to give you that. I want to try to give you some of my experience in the Black Panther Party, but in a way that how it helped to shape me and who I am today. So there's some things you got to know, right? 56, born in Plainfield, New Jersey. I came of political age maybe around 14 years old.
during the 67 rebellions. Before I joined the Black Panther Party, which was pretty much 1970, right? But 67, I don't. You should know, if you're students of the history of the movements, it was all kind of rebellions across the United States in different cities and Black communities. Plainfield, small town, it ain't even a city. You know, small town, but very racially divided. Civil rights movement, you see it on television every day. You see all these struggles going on around the world. You see the war that the United States is waging on the Vietnamese people, and you see the anti-war movement. You see women standing up for themselves and fighting back against certain sexism, sexual oppression in society. And I see this. I don't know how to figure it all out, but I know that Black movement, that civil rights movement, has something to do with me. You know, and it wasn't just the face of Martin Luther King in there, but it was you saw numbers of people in the streets. They may have been sit down strike. It may have been marching down the street, but then you saw how they were attacked, sometimes with dogs, German shepherds, sometimes with the fire department comes with water hoses, and they just water hose these people down the street like they're roaches. So here I am, I'm seeing this. There's issues in my hometown. But then Plainfield has a rebellion. It follows Detroit, and it follows Newark, New Jersey. One of the things that happened in my hometown, and it's probably something that it was small, you know, we knew each other in the Black community, you know, it was pretty small, but there was a gun manufacturing place right outside of Plainfield. And folks kind of made their way to the gun manufacturing place, broke in, brought out crates of M1 rifles, came back to the Black community, and they ran the police out, right? 6 days, just 6 mere days. But it was 6 days that was gonna change my life, because I seen my people come together. Now you gotta understand that this is like 1967. I'm like 14 years old, maybe 13, 14. But just my generation and that one before was still caught up into the whole, I won't say nigger ideology, you know, that we wasn't shit, if I may use that academic term, that we wasn't gonna be shit, that we would never organize, nothing, you know. And we felt that we could not even be proud of who we were, hair, skin color, nose structure, lips, you know. But now here's the 60s. Out of the civil rights movement, here comes a Black Power movement, here comes a Black is Beautiful movement, and it meant something. So during these rebellions, people were feeling a new sense of who they were. Nothing was impossible. In Che's words, you know, demand the impossible, you know. And in my hometown, I've seen Black people come together and have meetings and organize. I've seen cars come up in the area where we live, open up their trunks, and it was all kind of goods that they had just liberated from these stores. They didn't steal them or anything, they liberated them. Language became very important, and you're gonna hear some of it, why I say that later, you know. But they distributed the goods. They wasn't selling it, they wasn't hustling. You know, and when I saw that, I had this newfound sense of pride. One of the cars in particular, I never forget, black, like brand new car, Black car, and it had Black Power written on the hood. And it just stuck with me, and it sticks with me to this day. But to see my people take over their neighborhood and fight back, they ran the police out, the National Guard couldn't do anything until they brought in the tanks. They brought tanks into small playing field because they did not want this message going out to others that somewhere some Black folks had actually liberated themselves for a time, long enough to show what was possible. And they was after the guns. They was after the guns. They wanted to know where every gun and every crate was taken. Where was it at? You know, Robert Williams had wrote a book, Negroes with Guns. you know. And it was just talking about the importance historically of black people going to be free in this society, and we don't have the capacity to defend it, we will always be slaves in one form or another, you know. And Robert Williams' voice was out there. He had actually escaped being imprisoned in North Carolina, I think, and made his way to Cuba and then to China and had a communication underground radio station going when he was in Cuba. He had a newsletter coming out of China that was always giving us things to think about in terms of fighting back. We learned as we were fighting. I am like 14, 15, 16. The words of Stokely Carmichael and H. Red Brown was just like, you would hear them so regular, like it was just, you turn on the news, you're going to hear their voices. Black power, the power to determine the destiny of the black community. And then comes the Black Panther Party, you know. And the Black Panther Party was different because what we were saying, or what it was saying at the time before, was that not only did we have the right to be free, and not only did the Declaration of Independence and other laws of, you know, hypocritical writing say we did, but we had a right to defend it with guns. And me and my best friend at the time, Jihad, who was still, we're still very close, he's in Virginia now, we looked at a news magazine in Iraq in a store, and we saw a picture of Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. Black beret, black leather jacket, powder blue shirt, combat boots, and guns. And we respected the civil rights movement, but we knew that from our environment, that urban environment, that urban perspective, we didn't want to sit with water hose down the street. We didn't want to do some kind of other demo where these racist white folks can come and spit on you, and your tremendous discipline stops you from smacking the shit out of them. Mm-hmm. Academically, of course. But we wanted to fight back. We wanted to fight back like the Vietnamese was fighting back. We wanted to fight back like the liberation struggles in Asia and Africa. We wanted to fight back. So we wanted to join the Black Panther Party, and we searched them out until we found them. Who knows Jamal Joseph? He's one of the professors here, out of the Black Panther Party. He don't hide that. He doesn't hide it. But he tells a story which pretty much all of us experience. When you join the Black Panther Party, though, you want that uniform, because you're cool with that uniform, you know, and you want the guns. But when you go into that office and they see that you really have an interest, they give you weapons, but it ain't the guns. It's the books. It's the reading material. They say, if you're serious about this, you have to learn. Now, someone like me, I'm like a mediocre student in high school. You know, I don't really like to read. And the only thing they would really, you know, have you do these reading assignments on Shakespeare and all this other stuff, I just couldn't get into it, you know. So I pretty much didn't do that good in, like, the reading assignments. But now with this history, this revolution stuff, I am excited. I am reading everything I can get my hands on. So not only the Black Panther newspaper, but W.E.B. Du Bois on Black Reconstruction, Karl Marx on a Communist Manifesto. I ain't never heard of Karl Marx before. Mao Zedong's Little Red Book, Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth. And we had all read Malcolm X, and we was reading all that we could get on. But when I look back on it now and see how we was expanding our thinking and our ability to understand and analyze at the same time that we're going door to door organizing our communities, it was really fantastic. I mean, you got the group of people that had formerly didn't really believe in themselves, and now we're like, man, we can do this. We can understand our situation. We can break down capitalism now. We can understand the international scene and what is imperialism, and we're willing to do it, and we're willing to fight back. So here we are in Plainfield, we're doing it. We got an office going, we got a free lunch program going, but we started in the summer and not during school. We got soon got an office and get another storefront where we got a free clothing program. We are organizing mainly high school students with a few adults, but people were taking notice of us. And we didn't know the FBI was at the time, just the local police was harassing us all the time. Why such a focus on the Black Panther Party? What was so different about the Black Panther Party? Certainly it wasn't these guns that they felt we was going to overthrow the most powerful military empire ever, but it was the ideas that we were putting forth. Not just a revolution, but the breakfast program, for example, was showing people a practical way to live differently. Where we said if the government is not going to provide our children with healthy meals when they go to school, we will do it. It meant that we had to actively turn towards each other. And you got to remember, just a generation before, we didn't have that kind of self-esteem. We didn't have it. When we looked at each other, it may not have been with loving eyes or eyes that said, well, we can mutually help each other here. But now we're looking at each other and say, man, we can pull this together. We can go to the churches, we can go to our neighbors. Sometimes our families would get involved and start a free breakfast program. Sometimes they would come to the liberation schools. What the FBI saw happening was that people were pulling out of that mindset that kept us locked into this system. Whether actively supporting it or supporting it out of our fear, which kept immobilizing us from being able to just resist. Being afraid to look back at our history and connect the dots, not what you learned in school, but what you learned in places like the liberation schools, W.E.B. Du Bois, what really happened during Reconstruction. How did we really get to the United States? What really happened on them plantations? Who was Nat Turner and Harriet Tubman, and why were they able to succeed? Even those who failed in their rebellions, they succeeded with the idea that you could fight back. Haiti, the Haitian Revolution, now we're learning about all this stuff, and we see that we're not isolated. So we were able to do things that no other generation could do. And I think we did it with a certain attitude, you know. I think generations before us, who were the fighters, who were the educators, who would stand up and speak out for us, it was always very carefully. But during the 60s, when we spoke our minds, boy, we spoke our minds. You heard the word pig. There was no other generation, or maybe except for the Wobblies, maybe, who would come up and identify to their face, police, politicians, landlord, you're a pig. Power to the people, death to the fascist pigs. Fascists. We didn't even know, we couldn't even say the word. We was fascists and everything. But then to learn, about what the word actually meant, and to make these connections, okay, Italy, Germany, yeah, but the United States, and to read 1984 and all these other books, we were learning at the same time. It was powerful. But Black communities, brown communities, Asian communities, poor white communities in the Appalachian Mountains began to organize, many inspired by the Black Panther Party, and able to come together in certain conferences and circles to try to envision a new America, what America might look like without racism and capitalism and imperialism. You know, it was like heady. It was romantic in a good way though, you know, but it kept us going. We could envision finally something that look like freedom for all people, respecting each people's different struggles and all of that. So here we are. We're doing so well in my hometown that they figured out a way to shut us down. I mean, every community's got violence, they got robberies, they got all kinds of things going on. It just so happens that a cop gets killed in my hometown. How do the police use it? They take me and Jihad, we're the main organizers, and they arrest us. They get four young black youth, 11 to 14 years old, take them down to the station, don't tell their parents anything. They put out a spread of pictures, but there's two pictures that are not quite a part of that spread. And they indicate to them, those are the ones you saw, right? And of course they said, yeah. Terrified. Next thing you know, we're charged for the murder of a cop. We are still teenagers. We're just entered senior year in high school. First teenagers in New Jersey to be charged as adults and also to be facing the death penalty. Not too much different from Mumia Abu-Jamal, right? But we was, it's so funny, when we think back on it now, we were prepared for it. We knew that things like that happened to people. They had killed Fred Hampton 2 years before. They had framed Huey Newton, who was in prison at the time. They was always trying to put some charges on Bobby Seale, murder charges in Connecticut, the Chicago 8, everything. We knew being in this struggle was dangerous, but we believed in what we were doing. So even sitting in this jail cell and our parents, you know, my mother says to this day, I say it was my sister's, but she say I gave her all her gray hair. I say my sister's gave me that hair. They're much older, you know how girls are. But anyhow, but my family freaked, and it wasn't for the fact though that, and poor, they was able to get some good lawyers. One who was a top-notch New Jersey lawyer, black lawyer, who I know to this day my family didn't pay. But he's seen the case, and he's seen a classic case of a frame-up. And the other lawyer was a public defender, you know, but one that wasn't trying to just, you know, shuttle somebody off into the prison to tell them to plead guilty and get off light. 14 months we're in the jail. The last 4 months is the trial. We already thinking ain't no justice in America. It's an all-white jury. We done got a hacksaw blade. We're trying to cut through these bars. Didn't make it. So here's the jury. Surprisingly, this all-white jury was able to see a frame-up and find us not guilty. And so we were free. Right after that, there's threats from the police. My family sends me down south. They send Jihad to Rochester, New York. 6 months later, though, I'm right back in Plainfield. We're reorganizing the Panther Party. But other chapters are under attack. Local police departments, special squads like in New York, Red Squad and others, and the FBI. People are getting arrested. People are getting charged with murder, ambushes and stuff. And so now I'm helping out the Harlem office and back and forth the playing field. But there's also Panthers who are part of the Black Liberation Army, which was the underground arm part of the Black Panther Party. Three of them are in the Manhattan House of Detention, which is called the Tombs. The Tombs is like downtown Manhattan. It's where the federal buildings are, the state, city, court buildings, everything is down there. Concrete and steel, police everywhere. We try to get them out. I'm recruited into the Black Liberation Army with a specific mission. Can we get these soldiers out of here because they're facing murder charges and death penalty in California? I am all of 19 years old. 16, 17 when we joined the Panthers. My girlfriend at the time is pregnant. What's going through my mind, can I have some water? What's going through my mind is that I want to be around for this child, you know? I want this child to be free. But we got to struggle, you know? And I didn't consult. I mean, I look back on it, I didn't consult my partner at the time and all like this, but this was all the stuff going through my mind, that if we fight, maybe even from the underground, and help the organizing in the communities, we can win. And maybe even if we don't make it, my child will be free. We just saw Sweet Honey in the Rock yesterday, and it was one of the things that they were saying, the message in their songs is that they know what they have to do through their music, you know, spread certain messages that reminds people or that inspires people to fight back or to fight for a better tomorrow. And that was ours as well. We may not make it, but the children will. So I'm underground. On this particular day, we plan to get them out of the visiting room of the tombs. And I don't know how quick I can do it, but just imagine this as a solid metal wall. and that there's little blocks that are windows, glass, and then there's telephones. The only way we can get them out is we gotta cut through this metal wall. Cut through the metal wall, downtown Manhattan, police and everything all around, right? Crazy, right? But you gotta be a little crazy if you wanna be free. You know, imagine Harriet Tubman. She was a little crazy. Not turning, you know, back and forth, back and forth. I mean, for real. I laugh now. But we decided that we was going to get an acetylene torch and just cut. We want our freedom fighters out. This is war. We had a war mentality. We actually had an anti-war mentality. We said that this has been part of war on us since they kidnapped us from Africa and put us on them slave ships and dumped us on this land, on a stolen land. We're fighting back. This is a continuous struggle. All right? So we want them out. And the reason I share this story, I share it for two reasons. One, you need to know. Two is that the statute of limitations ran out and they can't try me for it. But the reason I tell it is because I want you to know that we had to be daring. We wanted our people free. We were connected. The Panther Party was unique because we were connected to every revolutionary movement. If you wanted a different world, we said, let's hook up. We were different from many of the nationalists. We were a nationalist group, a revolutionary nationalist group. But we was like, listen, Appalachian Mountains, y'all wanna be free? Let's hook up. Students on the anti-war movement, you wanna stop war, you want a world without, you know, a world without war? Let's hook up. You know, workers, let's hook up. You know, Puerto Ricans, you want independence on Puerto Rico? Let's hook up. The Chicanos was fighting for their land back. They reminded people that the United States took that land in war. And we're hooking up. We're meeting. You know? So for us to go into the tombs to get them out, we're doing something that wasn't really a big deal for us. It was just part of what we were supposed to do. So anyway, I happen to have been the one that was supposed to do the cutting. I just didn't know acetylene torches that well. And I'm cutting, and I get about this far, and the oxygen tank runs out. And the oxygen is what really cuts through the metal when that fire is there. And if I wasn't the one that was supposed to do it, someone more experienced, but they couldn't do it at the time. So I crash course, I gotta learn this, and if I really knew it would have been zip, 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 zip. Four Black Liberation Army soldiers would have been out there, and probably all the other visitors, I mean the prisoners, who had visits that same time would have been coming out with them. Because other visitors on our side was just New York cool as anything else. Here we are with acetylene torches of guards and everything already locked up in the bathroom, you know. But we're sure that they would have came out, hopefully, maybe coming to the Black Liberation Army. This is an ongoing struggle. But it's that you have to be daring. Our actions are no different from Harriet Tubman's, Nat Turner's, or anyone that rebelled on that slave ship to get off. We understood the dangerousness of what we were doing, but we wanted to win. And if we did not even succeed, we wanted people to know what was possible if you were not afraid. If you were not afraid. And we were not afraid. And though we didn't get them out, as easy as it was for us to hook that up, we got out of there and we were gone. We couldn't get them though. But we were part now fully of the Black Liberation Army. Later on, it's the bank expropriation. That's why I say the thing about the words. The government might call it a bank robbery. We call it a bank expropriation. We came to get money. We said it belonged to the movement. That's all right that it's in the bank. You know, we also hit drug dealers and everything and put their money into the community too. And at a certain point, the armored cars were getting hit so much that money was going to the African liberation movements. And also, you know, community organizations within the United States. We were serious. We were that serious. But we were captured. Three of us was captured in New Haven, Connecticut. We get sentences. I ended up doing a little over 12 years. The other did 14. Another did 17. But from the first day in the courtroom, we tell the judge, you don't have the right to try us. We are soldiers of the Black Liberation Army. We are not going in there looking for justice. There has never been justice in the United States. We are soldiers, you know. We know we're going to get, you know, though all during that time too, we're looking for ways out, trying to get the hacksaw blades, maybe hoping that somebody might get one of these caravans taking us back and forth to the courtroom, free us. It didn't happen. But all through them years in prison, it was reading, educating, organizing, and trying to figure out ways to get out. All through them. And it happened for some. Some did get out. It didn't happen for me. It happened for Asada. Asada was able to get out. It happened for some others. But the goal was to get back to the streets so we could continue to fight. But this is like 1974. Our movements, pretty much all the movements, the FBI, local police departments had been able to like break many of these movements. You know, by the time I got out in the end of 85, people didn't even know that there was a Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. Young high school student in New Haven, Connecticut, I'm staying with my lawyer at the time. I asked him, what do you know about the Panthers? He asked me, was it a martial arts group? So I'm telling you this because the things that I learned are important. One is, why didn't the message get out? Why didn't, now that we know the government is not going to tell the story, why didn't our parents, why didn't our neighbors, why didn't our griots or historians tell the story? Because they were terrified of what might happen to them. Or if they're telling it to their children, they're terrified of what might happen to their children if their children should dare become like Panthers or like guerrillas for their people. Or like educators, not even the underground, or just doctors, but you're dedicating yourself to your community. So the story didn't get told. So we come out and there's nothing. Culture becomes important. Cultural studies become important. Media becomes important. Because after they shot a lot of us up, locked a lot of us up, ran a lot of us out of the country, it was the media war that really sealed it. Right? When you turned on the television and went to the movies now, you seen blaxploitation. You seen them glorifying pimps, pushers, you know, all those things. You didn't see the big Afro Angela Davis type people anymore. You didn't see the Stokely Carmichaels and stuff. You know? President Nixon raised his hand, not in black power, but in black capitalism. And here come all the black capitalism, want some of that pie, you know, and they bolster that rising black bourgeoisie, right? All to solidify their control, because we shook them a little bit. We shook them a little bit. And I want you to know that because I understand more and more of that as I read and reflect, you know? So when I read cultural studies, when I read feminism, when I read media studies, you know, when I read anthropology, and it's more the radical stuff, right? I get a chance to look at it through different lenses and we see like, wow, this was really complex. It wasn't really that simple, you know? How did they get to the point today where Kanye West can call Bush a racist and then now he's so sorry for it? What, for what reason? The man's a racist and a murderer, you know. But the power of this system, you know, is what we have to understand. And I find that people in university studies, and I still wish I was a student, you have access to these information, these knowledges, these different perspectives, you know, and they help you to really see how intricate and interconnected many of these things are, more than we understood. Our hearts was in the right place, but did we really understand how vicious this system is? Mm-mm. Did we really reflect on what white supremacy is, does, what it has been from the beginning, you know? And has it ever left? No. Do people want to talk about it? No. So we got post-racial America? No.
No. You still got the descendants of the same people who massacred, murdered, committed genocide, raped, pillaged in order to build this thing that that American flag waves towards. And just that some of us was like, no, no, we don't accept it, we won't accept it. Even if it means our death from just speaking out about it. All them disappeared bodies during the civil rights movement that we'll never know about because they're still in the bottom of some swamp somewhere, you know, who were just fighting for them kind of civil rights or to vote what this country did, right? And what will it do to us? You know, but should it stop you? And our thing is like, no, man, we deserve the best. You know, we have to figure this out. We have to think about how to resist in ways that allows us to spread our sense of hope or optimism for a better world. Somebody has to do it. Even if it's just for the children, somebody has to do it. You know. So my struggle has been Black Panther Party coming out of the Black Nationalist Movement, the Black Power Movement, the Revolutionary Nationalist Movement, and then at some point I become this anarchist. But the for me, when I look back, I see how it happened because it's that same desire to learn and want to know why we failed and how we can win. What did we miss? I started reading feminism in prison. And that ain't a place to read feminism. But then again, it's the best place. My comrades even see me reading feminism. They're like, Ashanti, what's going on with you, man? You know, I'm like, man, I want to understand what happened. What did we do? You know, because some of the sisters was pissed and were critical and we ignored it and we silenced them. That's the kind of struggle we want. Then I'm reading this anti-authoritarian stuff like the Frankfurt School, you know. I've never been exposed to this stuff, but there's some intellectuals in prison. There's a whole bunch of Malcolm X's in prison. And they just like share information. And we use our areas, our circles, to as debates or as ways to like put forth what one has learned and somebody else says, yeah, but I don't believe that. But we had, whether you was Muslim, whether you was communist, whether you was nationalist, or whether you was anarchist. And in these spaces, we learn. And sometimes it jars you in ways like, man, I never thought of that, but that's kind of heavy, you know? So for me, the feminism was like kind of heavy, especially when you see what you have done and things you don't want to perpetuate, you know? And then the kinds of different ways of organizing and reading the anarchism. And you don't always have to organize top down. Like, wow, really? We can organize horizontal? Wow. You know, I think immediately about what happened when the Black Panther Party, when there was a split and why there was a split. Because this top, that very top down body, everything came from the top and that power did corrupt. And those on the bottom who were the field workers, we suffered. Our ideas, our suggestions, our criticisms were never taken. I want to be involved with something different. So now I'm learning about the anti-authoritarian movements and the anarchism. And I'm challenged to like, I gotta leave that Panther. Not necessarily leave that Panther history, but certain practices, you know, because power to the people still, for me, is like, yeah, that's anarchism for me. If it's really to the people, and not just like there to hook the people so that when we win, you got a new class of oppressors, then I want to figure out ways where others are already trying to figure them out and doing them, of how to keep power with the people who's supposed to be making the decisions about their lives, you know. So here's, you know, my perspective keeps expanding, you know, and I am always challenged to learn, even when it's in difficult areas. And then some of the sexism was, like, for me, it was really difficult because I told people, like, I would rather do bank expropriations than to deal with certain aspects of sexism. Because sexism is hard, you know? I got more courage to go over that bank counter and like, yo, move aside, and the money, you know, than to face some of the things I do with women, personal life, political life, that's oppressive. What's more important, you know? And you learn that your relationships with each other is always most important, you know? It's always most important. And I read the psychologies too, and I mean, from Eric Fromm to Wilhelm Reich, which I really got a lot into Wilhelm Reich, which is why the one about the orgasm became, I like that. Right? Because I began to understand that if we're going to make revolution happen, it has to happen here at the same time that we're trying to bring out down these oppressive structures. We have to release and free stuff here. And it's hard. And then the special circumstances around where we're black people, where the indigenous people, we got some special things going on here, because they done wiped out damn near all the indigenous people, and they've kept black people, people of African descent, in slavery. Wiped out our language, our practices, our spiritualities, and kept those structures going in one form or another that it still affects us to this day, where we find it so hard to love ourselves and each other because of what we have been through and the trauma that has happened to us. So it calls for different things that other struggles may not have to deal with. You know? So constantly reading and constantly trying to figure out how to place these readings into practices. How do you do it? How do you message? How do you touch somebody, allow somebody else to touch you? How did you stop, you know, if you're a man, you know, being the dominating voice in the room? I'm the dominating voice in the room. But in order, so even for me to do this, it's important for me to share what I share so that you hear me, you know that I'm not trying to stay stuck in this man thing that I'm in. I'm trying to set an example. So that when we struggle for whatever the issue is, we need to know how it impacts those around us and closest to us. We need to know how it's going to challenge us in some really deep ways. You need to know that revolution has not ever just been about changing political and economic structures. That it goes much, much deeper. Even if one chooses to pick up a gun. You know, and I just got finished telling members of the new Black Panther Party. The Black Rioters Liberation Party out of LA, California. But they follow the teachings of the Black Panthers and George Jackson. And they've already had some incidents with guns and the police and everything else. And I never tell anybody, don't. I just want you to understand, but we tried to do what worked and what didn't work. Because you're going to have to make them decisions. You know. But the bottom line is, we have to bring the system down if we are going to be free. We have to really believe that we deserve the best. We have to believe that we have connections with all around us, from each other to the earth, to all that is, whether we call it God, universe, whatever, and we need to figure out ways to be in such healthy relationship that we don't destroy everything we have. So that's a much enlarged understanding. And I first came in as this young, angry nationalist that wanted the freedom of black people, didn't really care too much about white folks, didn't really like white folks. And it wasn't until I joined the Panther Party that I had to kind of let some of that go. Some of it go. Because we still have to deal with having healthy anti-racist practices amongst us. Especially when you're dealing with white folks, because it is ingrained. It is ingrained. So when we talk about this post-racial stuff, we also talk about those who deal with, you know, the fallacy of being in a post-racial nation. You know, my wife deals with criminology and social justice at UMass, and she uses this book called Colorblind Racism by Bonilla Silva, right? Who deals with a lot of this post-racial stuff and how the racism continues, it just kind of takes a different form. Not just in how we treat each other, but in the same structures are in place, you know? The same people are on the bottom. Those in prison, the majority of those who are black, when you trace back their ancestry is like plantation, you know? And when we talk about prison industrial complex being an extension of that, we have to expand that and say, so are our so-called communities, extensions of the prison industrial complex, things that are in place to keep black people under control. So when one talks about decolonization, one talks about neocolonialism, many still refer to us as being colonized, as being in need of decolonization, which means the death of the United States of America. And unpatriotic as that may sound, you know, but that structure, as long as it's in place, no one in this society will be free. No one, white folks included. Because to buy into white supremacy locks white folks down too, in terms of being able to be the kind of allies you need to be, or to be able to join with the others in the breaking down some of these structures. You know. But these are all the things that stem from my learning in the Black Panther Party that you had to constantly read. But it was reading in the midst of practice. Reading in the midst of working in the community. That's the only way that it can really work. If you just stay in your ivory tower, there's nothing. You know, you write a few books, there's nothing. But to engage in real life, it means everything. It means everything. Internet, it should be very secondary, maybe tertiary. It should be like, okay, it can help bring us together, but face to face is the best. Another reason why I moved to anarchism, because so much in anarchism was face to face, right? Break down structures of authority, right? Be willing to be jarred in your thinkings or the way that you do things in order to see something different. Very important. Are you a worker? Yes, of course you should control that workplace. Do you live in Spanish Harlem? Of course the people of Spanish Harlem should control Spanish Harlem. You know. Are you on a reservation? We should be helping them figure out how to free themselves in the reservations, even when there's uranium all in their area and the corporations is there getting that uranium with the backing of the United States. Agencies of repression. There's still Assata Shakur's in prison. Some who ain't coming out unless it's in a pine box, or some have already come out in pine boxes. Some folks are going to come forward and say, well, we got to get them out. That might have to be the case with Mumia. We need a movement that will not be confined to legalities, because legalities are always in the interest of perpetuating the system. That will not be confined to reforms, because reforms are always in the interest of perpetuating this system. And if it can't be used to get us a step further to bring them down, then don't use them at all. Audre Lorde's words are very important. You know, can we use the master's tool to bring the master's house down? I don't know. I don't know how we do it. Some say no. Can we vote? I think it's Dead Prez will say, if voting didn't get us into this mess, voting ain't gonna get us out. Who is it? Welfare poets. All right, I'm glad they're not here. You know. So, but those is the things that, you know, I would want you to get from me, that I see students the same way I see students back when I was young. You know, you have a role to play. Assata Shakur was a student. Asafia Bukhari was a student. There was many students who gave their lives to these struggles, organizing in the communities. What are your resources here? what can you bring to the communities that need you and the resources the most? What are you here for? You know, is it just a career, or does it change the world? You know, and I hope it's to change the world. And I'm with Malcolm, by any means necessary. You know, and I want you to think about that. 56, I did not expect to make it past 20. I didn't. So I got some time now. I gotta have some time now because I got married and we got a 10-month-old. I didn't think that was gonna happen. You know, and to see raising a child as a most revolutionary thing to do, right? Mm-hmm. And for me being the house husband, I get some sense, I ain't gonna say fully, of what it is for women who are mothers to raise a child. I mean, I don't know, it's single parent. Me and Vivian and Estelle talked today, how does a single parent do it? But to know that when we do these things, it's very important. How we raise a child is very important, you know? How we treat each other is very important. How we get each other's back is very important. How we take care of each other is very important. The risk we are willing to take to break that, there was the thing about race traitors. I think there also has to be man traitors. You know, those of us who are men but will not just carry on those destructive practices of what we consider men amongst each other in the destructive ways, like to just say, no, we will try something different. No, we will speak out. No, we will challenge this and that. Because the better that we feel amongst each other in the relationships that we create, the more powerful we are. And I try to get people to envision, I'm gonna stop, that when we can touch each other and then more nurturing ways, the better ways, the non-harmful ways. I try to get people to imagine armies of your enemy advancing on you, but every time you're able to take that risky step, columns of that army begin to fall, you know? So that you'll see it's not just you fighting them, that army with guns. It's the ways that we are challenging ourselves to treat each other, to back each other, to defend each other, that also stops them advancing armies of oppression. You know, just as important as someone who has to slip on the ground and do other things. You know, so I want people to see, especially like men, I want us to see that when we don't engage in homophobic activities, legions of the enemy falls, you know, walls break down, crumble down. You know, when women get the courage to stand up to an abusive partner, columns fall. We are creating that world that we know we deserve. We have that idea, we have it, and we learn it more and more each day. We get inklings that it's possible. We got to hold on to it with everything you got. From your position here, you got advantages, you got privileges, and you must use it. Right on. So I'm gonna stop because if you have any questions or we're getting back and forth. But understand that you are the hope of the future. I'm moving into the elder category. And I'm hoping that when we win, you remember that all I ask for is a case of tequila. And me and Biko can be playing on the beach somewhere, and I can say, oh yeah, we did this and did that. He probably won't listen to me for long. But, you know, just know we can win. Really believe it. We can win. Power to the people.
Power to the people.
Okay, here's what I wanted to end with. Where'd she go? I wanted to end with this. Okay, it's welfare poets, right? Where's she going? Well, when she comes back, maybe we can do question and answer, but Vivian uses, she does this presentation. Like I said, she's criminology and social justice. And in UMass, Dartmouth. Yeah, I wanted you to know if you would start.
Oh, Oh, yeah.
Okay. I've been to her classes, right? And she got this degree in this field in order to tear criminal justice and criminology to pieces. And you got to imagine where she's at. She gets students who want to be cops. They want to go into the military. They want to go into the CIA. You know, they ain't liking what she's saying. But her job is to give it to you, whether you like it or not. This is what the class, you chose it or whatever. But one of the things she uses is this war perspective. I mean, you have to keep in people's mind what white supremacy has done. The Zapatistas talk about a 500-year war. And she will put it into a perspective to show you how they have taken and defined their own history, which we come to kind of accept as common sense. And she'll say, no, they were not only folks here before Columbus, but what happened way before Columbus? Why was it that at a certain point, certain people get in their minds that they are going to dominate the world based off some crazy idea of the color of their skin gives them this godlike power? But she uses different war to end her sessions. And it's to show you also, like, I'm not a university educator, but your information comes from all fields, whether they're university people with books and whatnot, or whether they're your griots right from your community. And that could be the hip-hop, the poets, you know, the storytellers, but they have analysis. And a lot of times their analysis is sharper than what comes out of the university. So this is, it's called war. Now his name is Biko, not Johnny.
Biko after Stephen Biko. And Johnny is Yoruba for he who leads the struggle. So we're going to hope that he don't mind this name as he gets older.
Opportunities. You know what I mean? It's war. Yo, stick. I mean, should be real war. Pigs be out there, occupied army. RBGs, it's a takeover, not a makeover. Yeah. The cops stop me just because you black, that's war. When you through the system for your grants, that's war. When they call my hood a drug zone, that's war. Slumlord charging you for rent, that's war. Why they so rich and we poor, that's war. If you young and black, you sell crack, that's war. The White House is the rock house, that's war. George Bush coming out his mouth, that's war. Chilling on the corner with your gang, that's war. Hope we'll do the same damn thing, that's war. When they murdered Amadou Diallo, that's war. Marching in the streets is a strategy of war. Knowing self-defense is a strategy of war. Soldiers trying to link with other soldiers in the war. Revolutionaries got to know the art of war. War, what about hip-hop? Use that. Matter of fact, fuck a rap battle. What about a gap battle? Let's take it to the beast and see which cat tattle. Is it Kiss versus Beans or B versus Hove? What about y'all real niggas against the 5-0? This is M1, DPs, don't you forget. Cause you can talk, 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 but that don't mean shit. I ain't gotta pop your top to see where your brains went. This rap shit is way bigger than entertainment. It's the people first, the pigs when it all go down. It's not pop first, big, it's who's getting the power. The power ain't money, dog, it's self-determination. Like taking hot and making it the real people station, that's war. I mean, yeah, rap war, whatever war, you live a fast life, more or less, more so, it's still war. Dead prayers, the people radio, yeah. Get down, get down, get down, RPGs and biatch.
You are now listening to WRBG, the people's radio. It's a takeover, not a makeover.
Okay. So any questions, comments, stuff like that, feel free.
I have a comment.
My name is Margaret. I'm a Brazilian. I've been here for 3 months, and I'm a visiting professor coming from a Brazilian university to teach here at Columbia. And my course is on history of anarchism in Brazil.
Okay.
Yeah, I have been working with anarchist groups in Brazil for a long time. But the thing I want to tell you is very short, is that when I was 20, we in Brazil were fighting against military dictatorships.
Right.
That started in 1964
right.
until 1985. And by that time I was at the University of São Paulo. And I don't know exactly how, but the things of Black Panther came on TV in Brazil, came on the radio, came on the newspapers, and we all read the same things. The things you wrote, the things you fight for.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to tell you how strong was the influence, the impact of Black Panther's movement. Of course, middle class girls like me at that time, leftist, of course, leftist. We had these posters of Angela Davis in our classes at the universities. We admired so much. Because in Brazil, the black movement hadn't started yet. Even though we had some leftist black, but you know, they were very humble at that time, like in the United States in the 50s. So it was also a strong impact to the black people in Brazil, and that's when the black movement started in the beginning of the 70s.
Right.
But I didn't belong to the black movement, I belonged to the students movement at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So things weren't so well defined,
right.
Because we were all involved in this fight against dictatorship.
Right.
So this was a very hard time in Brazil, and absolutely difficult. And I just wanted to tell you that your impact, that the ideas you defended, the books you read, the things you have said here weren't only important for Americans or for your community, but they crossed the ocean and they came to Brazil.
Well, thank you.
So thank you. Black Panthers, for all that.
Well,
and thank you for becoming
One of the books that I didn't mention that was required of reading was Carlos Marighella's book. On urban guerrilla warfare.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, because we in the Panther Party we assumed that many folks was going to go into the underground, and so we had to learn how did other struggles deal with it. And his book was like major because it dealt with urban guerrilla warfare.
But I think I think now I realize that we all shared an international reading, like Frantz Fanon, from I don't know, James Baldwin, so Carmichael,
right.
And all these people, and also the songs, Tom Baez, Bob Dylan, they crossed the oceans. So we had a network and we didn't know it.
Yeah. and her sharing that, it's important for people to know. Sometimes you feel like it's just you doing that, doing stuff here.
Yeah.
And really, you don't know how much your stuff spreads.
And also Reich. So
Wilhelm Reich.
I also read this orgasm story. So thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for the opportunity of being here since she invited us to come.
Anyone else?
Can you tell us more about your work with the Zapatista community? What was the connection?
Yeah. I went first time in the late 90s, maybe a few years after the Zapatista uprising in 94. The thing that I would want to share is like there's times where I say we lost. By the mid-70s, that the government counterintelligence program crushed us. And some people don't like me to say that. But I just think it's true. If you're going to be honest, you say that, then you go back to the drawing board and try to figure out where you went wrong. You get out of prison, there's nothing going on. There's no kind of movement. People don't even want to talk about it. I have my ups and downs, you know, in terms of, man, are we going to pull this together? We're trying to organize around political prisoners. We're trying to organize in the community just to be able to fight back, and no one's really interested. Then certain things happen that kind of like remind you that it's not hopeless, right?
So when the Zapatista uprising happened on January 1st, 1994, many of us was like, what is this? And not only that, but just the style of the Zapatistas, their perspective was so different. Here was a typical guerrilla group that wasn't like out of the Marxist tradition, like we're going to capture state power. We're going to organize the peasants and we're going to capture state power. The fact that they wasn't about that, like, oh man, as an anarchist, I want to know more about them. They didn't call themselves anarchists. But the fact that they had prepared this uprising over a 10-year period, organizing in their communities, you know, based on so much on Mayan, the Mayan culture that was already there, was just unique. It taught us that, you know, one can't ignore that your real strength is your people. Your people's culture, your people's resources, like right there. So the story is that Marcos and the other ones from the universities decide they're all Marxists, Maoists, and stuff. They're going to go to the hills and they're going to organize these peasants. And then they get there and they have to humble themselves. The peasants say, "Man, listen, all that highfalutin language you're using, we don't know what you're talking about, but we know we want to be free from this 500 years." And they had to accept that their advanced ideas meant nothing. But if you want to sit down at the table together and share ideas, then maybe we can learn something. And that basically is what happened and made this Zapatista movement so unique, that they can be rooted in the Mayan culture and yet also be postmodern or post-structuralist, I think I'm going to say that. But that they're able to deal with a new reality, and that they were able to use the internet to spread their message, you know, and that they were able to use traditional symbols, you know, to remind people of who they are and also to galvanize people. So I wanted to go. And some of the anarchists in New York, Anarchist Black Cross, knew that I wanted to go. And I ain't had no money, I wasn't working at the time. But they raised some money, and so we went. And so we go there, and like to go into the Zapatista community, you just can't walk in, you gotta be introduced, they will decide. But to be on liberated territory, right? In the midst of war, you know, the Mexican government was still trying to crush them, but to see them practicing their freedom, you know, in the midst of all of this was just mind blowing. You know, so I ended up going like 3 or 4 more times because I want to understand. And that might be way up in the hills of Southeast Mexico and not urban, but it's the lessons that I was getting was about how to be a revolutionary, you got to be creative, that you got to draw on your people's strengths, that even if you're in an urban setting, you can take them areas over because that's where you live. Take them back. Take your life back where you are. Draw on what you have. You know, the enemy being so technological is not necessarily a strength. It can be a great weakness. And this is what I was learning from them. You know, so coming back I become a part of the Estación Libre, which is a people of color organization whose main goal was to just get more people of color from the United States to go over there. And so we were bringing people over who were organizers in different communities around the country to see what a poor movement was able to do against the Mexican government in cahoots with the United States government and corporate interests, NAFTA and all that other stuff, you know, but to create their own world. You know, so the Zapatista said, we want to create a world where many worlds exist. And for me here in the United States, I'm like, I'm a nationalist. My primary goal is the liberation of black people. I'm in unity with everybody else that wants to be free. But that's my primary goal. So a world where many worlds exist, I like that. You know, because it sounds like it's a development from some of the things we tried to do in the Panther Party that wasn't able to do. You know. They said, walking, we ask questions. And it said that their revolution was not the one that had all the answers, but that walking,
you'll ask questions and you'll figure it out along the road. So I, for me to get away from them European revolutionary theories that had everything worked out, you just had to organize this way, you had to base it on this class, I was so happy to get away from that. And that here's a group that was actually practicing that. No one thought that these poor Mayan folks and these mountains would become the shining light, not only of Mexican people, but all around the world, inspiring so many people like you talking about. They wasn't doing it to be inspiring to the world, they just wanted to be free, you know. But to this day, I mean, some of them communities still exist, they still got challenges. But for me, the primary lesson is that we can have Zapatista-style revolutions right here in the United States. People got to believe that they can do it, and they got to realize that it's not based off of the government fundings or them corporate fundings. It's based off your own resources and your own creativity, you know. So for me, it's like that struggle has offered so much to kind of break away from a certain old revolutionary mindset and to get people to thinking differently. Sorry, it took kind of long. Anybody else? It may be that I'm talking too much. So y'all, it don't have to be questions either, it can be comments.
This is kind of like a comment slash question. There's this thing that I've been researching called, it's like this 2012 Rising of the Black People type of movement. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of it?
Mm-hmm. We got 2 years ago, 1 year ago.
Okay, well, never mind.
Well, tell me, what is it about?
It's just basically like the black people are just gonna just rise up and not take over, but kind of take over in a sense. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I got to do more research on it.
Okay.
I
mean, when I hear things like that, I just want us to be focused on just taking over our lives.
Right.
The reaction is, especially from the real racist crew, is that we want to take over and throw them into slavery. You know, like, come on, man, we want to be free. Mm-hmm. You know, and anybody else that want to be free, let's work together. You know, but if your racism can't get you out of that, like even Obama, who's nowhere revolutionary and even liberal, people was like, you know, so in reaction against mm-hmm. him even running, mm-hmm. you know. And it shows you some of the structures that we're going to have to fight. I always try to tell people, imagine where you live is a Harlem situation, and you just want that Harlem to be free. You know, how can it happen? I don't believe in no magical dates, I'm going to tell you the truth. You know, whether what calendar it is or whatever, freedom happens, liberation happens from our work. Mm-hmm. You know, and how smart we can do it, you know. But I tell you, the situation for me, for black people, is so worse than what it was when I was coming up. It is so work, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. If we do not pull it together, I can't imagine how much further we can go, you know. So we have to really step up, we really do. From whatever our situation is in life, we have to step up. And ain't nobody gonna free black people but black people, you know. So all of you in here, hear me, you know. Because black death is what keeps America up, you know. And people don't like that, that's too bad, because we the ones dying. You don't like it for some intellectual reason. Mm-hmm. We the ones dying. We the ones going to prison, you know. And that welfare industry too is it keeps another huge section of us locked down. So many ways that they're keeping us locked down. Our communities are really, you know, with the militarization of the police and the cameras and everything there, no different, I don't think, than the concentration camps that they had the European Jews in. You know, we have got to move. The urgency. I don't know how to get that sense of urgency across the people, you know, which is why I never to this day, and I hate to say that, especially now, I never say I'm not going back to prison. I never say I'm not going to pick up a gun. I'm never saying any of that stuff. I want us to be free. That's just it.
I ain't going for none of this other stuff where they try to fool us into believing like, oh, everything's okay. You just got to give so-and-so a chance, you know. Or if we can mobilize the vote over here, you know. So, black people.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience. And I really appreciate that you brought up that the power of ideology, both white supremacy and patriarchy, and how they have been used together to facilitate oppression. And in terms of like that black people are in a worse state today, the use of ideology, and I'm glad that you brought up also the work of Bonias Silva, mm-hmm. and how it has shifted like more to like a very kind of overt ideology of oppression to a much more subtle kind of colorblind, mm-hmm. post-race, and how that is part of like why we're in a worse situation, mm-hmm. because without a kind of obvious kind of enemy, because it's not even about representation, mm-hmm. any, you know, it's really more about like ideology, mm-hmm. and how that is now even more powerful in terms of keeping people locked in a certain type of mentality with like more of a kind of colorblind, multicultural ideology happening. And so I'm interested in how an anarchist perspective and the principles of that can kind of challenge what is now, I think, an even more difficult struggle.
Mm-hmm. I tell you the truth, I think maybe old school anarchism is not going to offer a lot. It's those anarchists who are also realizing that they need to incorporate cultural studies, radical feminism, radical psychologies, radical anthropologies, and different things. And then you realize that, man, you just can't deal with these founders of anarchism like they your new Jesus, you know, or them textbooks as they your new Bibles. You've got to also expand, challenge yourself. So for me, it's this anarchism's concern with structures of oppression and authoritarianism has to be applied to all of these new things now. So the colorblind racism, you know, it's like, well, what does culture studies have to say about that? What do bell hooks got to say about that? You know, or what do you have to say about it, you know? Around language, you know, we have to be all right with using Foucault and Bourdieu and all these other people. I'm reading now and trying to understand Kristeva and like me not being this, I wish I was a university student because sometimes the language is so dense. But then when she talks about horror, you know, or other writers now who are talking about historical trauma and historical memory, it's like, for me, I have to see how that can, those understandings can work for me. But my concern is to provide a practice that keeps us on an even level, that does not allow for them tendencies of one or few to dominate, you know, whether it's within our own communities or whether it's sometimes our tendencies, like you can have a meeting of 100 black people and one white person can walk in the room and it shuts all them black people down. So what does that mean? How can we use the psychologies and stuff like that to understand how so much of these structures of domination are in us and they're not just all outside of us, you know? So it's been me reading all these different things and I sometimes overwhelmed, but I'm glad that it's a struggle with many, many other people. You know, because sometimes I will Google a professor if I think that they can help me to understand just one word. Like, yo, can you just break this word down for me to understand what, you know, it means? But something tells me that it would help me to understand the oppression of our people more deep, and in that get some kind of inkling on how we might do a little organizing differently that we haven't been able to do. For example, around historical trauma and historical memory, there's indigenous folks now who incorporate practices that help their communities deal with intergenerational trauma. You know, they understand why there's high rates of alcoholism, depression, suicide amongst indigenous communities. They know it's connected to their conquest and damn near being wiped out, you know. So they have to incorporate these new understandings in there. So for me, it's like, well, I want to get the author of this certain book that is kind of pushing this. I want to get it so I can read and see, well, how does that apply to black people? You know, and there's already people writing on it, you know. I want to understand why it's so hard for black people to come together, you know. And it is very hard, but we've got a lot that we deal with. That trip on that slave boat meant a lot. That treatment we got in them plantations meant a lot. Still with us. One of the things I remember, just real brief, one of the things I remember coming out in the 80s, in the mid, late 80s, was that here you got Nixon with the black capitalism, here you got the black capitalists coming, but the things that people were saying in the community now was that, well, if black people ain't doing better, it's our own fault. Mm-hmm. You know? And I'm like, wow, that's so different from the 60s and the 70s. We wasn't saying that. You know? And even to this day, you know, it's like it's still there. If we're not doing better, it's our own fault. Look at Oprah. Look at all these other superstars. You know? It's our own fault. So in our organizing, we got to figure out ways to get into that as well. It can't just be handing a paper and say, hey, read this, or come to this meeting, or come to this demo. Revolutionary work has to take on different character. Maybe the primary work is like, how do we deal with the trauma? How do we deal with the intergenerational trauma that's even in our kids, who we still force into the school system that is destroying them? How do you convince parents, like, yo, what are you doing? You're killing them. You're killing their minds, you're killing their spirits, and yet want them to bring you great grades, A's, and, you know, everything, make me proud. You know, it was so different from the 60s and 70s, where there was independent schools going on. You know, we were learning as much from the neighborhood historians as we was from the schools. But look how this system has been able to pull us away from that and reject that. And to frame us as, we're just these nuts from the 60s, we're these extremists that, oh man, we just caught up in the past. So I think that there's even, you know, like, even as an anarchist, I got problems with a lot of others, because I'm still a nationalist. And if you can't, you're not supposed to be an anarchist if you're a nationalist. But I say I'm not for a nation state. I ain't saying that I want to build a state with armed forces and a government that's going to do the same thing. I'm saying there's other things we can do in terms of making decisions. It don't have to resemble this hierarchical structure. And there's all kind of examples. You just got to think about it. What was going on before there was these hierarchies? In critical resistance, we said once there were no prisons, that time shall come again. We done had prisons so long, we think it's natural. What were people doing to create a sense of safety and order in their communities before police, government, prisons came? There was different things that we did that was collective, that was rooted in the communities, in our traditions, wherever we're from, not just communities of color. What happened when the change happened? And we began to like distance ourselves and not believe in our own abilities, but to give everything to experts, you know? So for me, that like there, the anarchists, we're all right on all of that, but it's just to see that black people, we're here. We're the only people that this has been done to. They not only kidnap us from here to Brazil, you know, you take us from our land and put us on stolen land, keep us down. Now, we ain't going in masses back to Africa, but we got to make it happen here on stolen land. Right? But we can do it in a way that we don't replicate new systems of oppression. And that's what I get from the anarchism, but it's with the help of different understandings as well that come from different fields of the sciences. And not just the Western sciences. So not just those sciences that meet Western standards, that also mean indigenous sciences that maybe don't meet that other stuff, you know. That's our challenge. Yeah.
Hi. Yeah. Would you care to address the audience the effect of the media that's playing on the effeminization of black male? You know, now we have this new play out on Broadway where they're making a mockery out of us with the Scottsboro Boys.
Uh-huh.
And there's been one protest from the December 12th movement about that. They're going to continue to do it, but they just want the population to be aware of how they turn a tragic incident of our history into a minstrel show.
Right.
We have Tyler Perry and his continuous degeneration.
For Colored Girls.
For Colored Girls. Mm-hmm. Medea, you know, this big black woman with the gun, with mm-hmm. the foul mouth.
Mm-hmm.
The reversal of the gender roles.
You may have came in late because
I did.
But to go back to the media, right? I do this reading, and I read also a lot about war and conquest, and because I want to understand what happens after conquest, you know. And so I think of what these people here that who became the United States, what did they do once they conquered African people and brought us here and enslaved us? You have to now set in place all kind of ideology and institutions to perpetuate that. You have to tell these Africans that they ain't nobody, they ain't even Africans. You know, you're slaves. To the point where you'll hear us say, you know, oh, my great-great-great-grandfather was a slave. Instead of saying an enslaved African, say, well, they were slaves. But the point of media is this. The 60s, the 70s, counterintelligence program, by the mid-70s, for all practical purposes, our movements were destroyed. I think their mop-up operation has to be seen in terms of the use of media. That's what I was talking before about blaxploitation movies and all of the other ones. In order to shore up them being shook a little bit, they have to bombard us with these different images that they want us to take on. So it's no longer the black revolutionary, the black revolutionary minister, the black revolutionary artist. It's the super fly, you know. It's the pimp. It's the pusher. It's the gangster. Or it's the person who makes money, leading up today to 50 Cent and all these other people, right? So now the bombardment continues every day. Like, I didn't know about the thing you're talking about, but it follows into what they will allow all kind of media access and what they don't, you know? So why does Tyler Perry get that? There's a reason for it. He's portraying women. Black women can portray themselves. Why must a man do that?
Right.
And it's just perpetuation of white supremacy, you know? Even when it's a black person that's doing, you know, so these things become very important. So that's why I say, if people understand media, we must understand, if people are into media here, then how can you use that to provide resources to your communities to counter them images? So if a group is going down there protesting, that might be what needs to be done. If a group is an art group that wants to promote your own movie, the kind of movie or play, or art piece in any form, to counter them images, that also has to happen while others are organizing, while others are doing legal work, while others are doing child care, while others is plotting on how to get Mumia out of prison, you know. Or I don't know if people are running into banks anymore, but, you know. But anyhow, I mean, but this is what I'm trying to tell you, is that media was so effective that so many cop shows came out in the 70s. When they portrayed us, black, white, or whatever, we were crazy. We were extremists. And we always got caught. So you imagine the little kids coming up. Why are you going to be this crazy person that's just going to get caught? And the parents who it just reinforces what they already knew happened from watching on the sidelines. You know, so we're locked.
How do we get people out of that kind of hopelessness that there's no sense in fighting back? I was hoping the color girls was going to be different until you said that. You know, because I remember when, just a short example, I'm in Lewisburg prison when the play came out.
Yes.
And this is when I'm reading all this feminist material. So I learn about color girls. Somebody sends me the book. And I'm like, wow, right on, this is powerful. And who's opposed to it is groups like the NAACP and some of them other black male-led groups, really opposed to these black women for putting their voice out here, you know. But I am learning to stand up for these good productions, you know. And it's the same thing. I mean, we have to learn how to stand up and support good productions, whether they in art, whether they're in political organizing, whether they're in relationship behavior, you know, whether they're in child rearing children. We have to learn to support these things, because that's what makes this revolution happen, you know. But know that they murder so many people's mindsets and spirit through the media, you know. Even now, I mean, we're like with Biko, and we really regulating, but when that television is on, my man's head go right to that television, you know. Come on, responsible parents, come on. We just can't just let him, oh, that's cute, mm-hmm. you know. No, we have to regulate that stuff. We want him to be healthy. We want him to have a chance, you know, and to be there for him. And unison with other parents out here trying to do the same thing, you know. It is war. It is war.
So, wait, sorry, we have about, like, 10 minutes left, so maybe one more question.
Just kind of more of a comment, but I think what I get from your work, and it's important, is that the primary move that needs to happen is that the struggle needs to articulate the people first and not the state first. And I think the reason that the Project of Whiteness has become and is so powerful is that they understand the need for fluidity in a movement. So whiteness is not the same as it was 100 years ago, you know? Different categories get introduced, ethnicity, so then all of a sudden Italians, Irish, Jewish people are now considered to be white as well. And so I think one of the most important things, and if you look at movements that are growing and movements that are powerful in a sense, the Zapatistas, the different movements in the Iroquois Six Nations, or even in Eastern Africa, is that they recognize that the first thing that needs to happen is that the movement needs to be articulated to the people first, mm-hmm. and then also that the movement needs to be fluid in order to understand the intersectionality that happens among different oppressed people. Mm-hmm. And also realizing that just because you occupy an oppressed space, that you cannot also occupy an oppressive space. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you can maybe comment in that line of thought about the lack of indigenous solidarity work that's happening in the United States, and whether you think it's because of just the lack of indigenous politics in the discourse as perpetuated by the United States government, you know, the complete totalization that they're not even here, mm-hmm. you know, or if it's because of a fear of fragmenting the articulation of whether it be the black movement or whatever it may be. Do you see a distinction between those two things, or do you think that it's both of those things at the same time?
Well, one, I want you to first define how you use an indigenous.
Yeah, so when I'm talking about indigenous, I'm talking about pre-Columbus.
Right.
So that's how I'm going to, for the sake of this conversation, okay. define it. Obviously, there's other complexities that are happening. Mm-hmm. You know, there's embodiments of both black and indigenous.
Right.
You know? But even the denial of that hybrid.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, I'm not sure if I can even answer it other than what you laid out is really food for thought. But what I think I understand is that we've been under this system so long that it's hard to get indigenous folks, the folks from the who were here originally, or those of us brought here, to get us to hear a different message when the other one is laid in us so deeply, you know.
So like even when you know, people hear Malcolm's speeches and you hear people in the audience and like they're really riled up by his speeches, but what do they do afterwards? You know, or when the Panthers was out there, it's like not like everybody was joining the movement. It was only some, but others who just could not shake a certain, I think it's dealing with a certain insecurity when somebody brings you a different message that becomes so contrary to what you have accepted from generations, it's hard for you to shift. This is why like the readings I'll do are even in rhetoric, right? You got people who just study rhetoric, right? And they'll take a Stokely Carmichael speech and just analyze it, and they'll analyze the reception in the audience. And for me, it's like, okay, I need to understand why it is that people who can hear something and know it's right can still deny it and not do anything with it, you know? I want to know why people, perfect example, why so many black people voted for Obama when this country from day one has enslaved us, has kept us on the bottom. What makes us trust? What makes us trust, you know, that Obama is going to do something for black people? The messaging becomes like, you know, why do we accept the things that we know deep down? 9/11, just a quick example. 9/11, I live in New York at the time. Me and my partner at the time, we live in Brooklyn. We are catching the train over into Manhattan because that's where we work. It happened to be catching it at the time these planes hit. It's so funny. But so we don't know what's going on, but everybody's eyes is riveted to this one side of the train because we're going over the bridge. You see all these billows of smoke. We get into Manhattan, and then you're hearing all these things about, oh, they just drove two planes into the World Trade Center, you know. And when we heard that, I think both of us was like, well, right on, you know. finally, somebody has struck back at this monster. Finally. Yeah, I know thousands of people died. I know. But they have killed so many other millions and millions and millions and millions, you know. And I went to work, which is working for ex-cons and stuff, and I was just hoping for a phone call from some of my comrades somewhere and say, Ashanti, it's on, meet us at so-and-so. I would have left that job, and that would have been it. But it didn't happen. So all the traffic is tied up. You can't, the trains are stopped and everything, so everybody's trying to get home. We're on a train station in Brooklyn. Platform is kind of outside. Here's all these people stranded, can't get away. So conversations is going on. There's one person on this one brother who's saying, oh man, that's these terrorists, that's Bin Laden, we gotta get him. And me and this other brother listening to him like, what is you talking about getting Bin Laden? He ain't done nothing to us. And if he struck at the United States, what has that got to do with you? You know? So I'm not getting into it. Sometimes I get tired of engaging. But then another brother come on who's stranded, and he say, yo man, let's get in the conversation. So we get in the conversation, and to me, it's like this brother is speaking out of, you know, he's got this recording in his head that he's going on about, you know, somebody needs to step in there and break that recording so everybody else stop nodding to everything he's saying. So we're reminding him that we were just complaining about Bush stole the election. We remind him that this country enslaved us. We reminded him and everybody listening that we know the media lies. Now everybody is nodding at us. Yeah, you're right. But it seems like we have to figure out ways to break that recording that gets us to just go to their message when we know, you know. So I don't have it all, but the other thing when you say about articulating is for me, what I have found that works is that not so much us articulating for people, but we need to be in situations where we allow people to articulate their own situation because they really do know. Mm-hmm. And when it's in a collective setting, I learned this in critical resistance, we have the big paper up, we have everything, and the issue is prisons. And instead of people just right off coming with the recordings, oh man, we need prisons, man, there's too much crime in the community, we start to remind them of certain things about prison.
you know, about who gets locked up and who don't get locked up, mm-hmm. about these corporations that make all these money off of that. Do you think it's that innocent? Then now they start to put it together and we're writing down their thoughts. And they see from the collective process that they can see something that's really going on and that they were buying into something. So for me, you know, the thing about getting people in situations where they learn to kind of pull together what they really know. With the help of others, fine, but you really know that life is fucked up, you know, and it's not your fault. And then they can kind of start to formulate their own plan about what to do, you know, and that for me means that it's going to come from the people. And if we have some ideas as the revolutionaries or people in the know, we can put our ideas out there, you know, but always recognize, just like with the Zapatistas, you know, that common people got ideas too, got ways that they analyze the situation too. And if that we lend ourselves to that, they can see that they can think and that they can act. And that revolution for me means that it's going to stay rooted in the people. And it's not going to get a reliance on those of us who, because we've read a few things or we've been through the university, we're the ones that know everything. You know, so. Great collection of people. I believe that we can change this world. So I you know, push you. Let's do this. Don't let anybody tell you we can't. And the university's got a part to play.
I just wanted to make a quick little announcement. If you didn't do the sign in sheet, which Nick has in the back over there, please sign in. That's how we can have two of these events, and it's going to be easy on our mailing list. I also wanted to thank Nick for being an amazing activist. Thank you for putting up all these flyers all over the city. He's amazing. And please eat the food or take it with you. Otherwise, we'll bring it to the shelter.